Even today, Hawk owns the entire silica analysis.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the steam generation and the big boiler systems.
And that's
nobody matches us in that.
That's a very important matter.
But it's no longer capillary flow. They're pumps.
But that's a very important measurement in the production of integrated circuits. They have to have ultra pure water. And Clifford, he probably almost had more excitement or passion about a process instrument. He saw a process instrument when they're perfected, but that gives, so it's a continuous readout of...
We will have the perfect process instrument when we make the perfect pump.
Yeah.
How many times have I heard that?
But we almost got to process turbidity, and that would be, boy, that would be the turbidity at the final filter, the final... The final polished water that's gone through the filter. There's usually a process turbine almost virtually every one. And we've sold, I think we're up to like 20,000.
And our customers there are Intel and Micro.
So yeah, that was, but those started also in about the mid-1950s and process instruments. So then that kind of rounds it out. We had the visual tests. And the other thing I also want to mention as far as the chemical orientation, there was also chemistry within chemistry. We actually, on some of the visual wheels, the little color continuous wheels would be a visual color comparison of the sample, and then there'd be a measurement scale that would actually be a graduated change in color. We formulated...
Do you have one of those colored discs?
I think I can go get one, yeah. But there was actually there was a specific polymer chemistry to be able to formulate that graduation of the color circle. And we actually did that too. So we actually got into chemistry to support chemistry. And in the case of turbidity, the most difficult thing in turbidity was the recalibration of a product. And that was done with Formazin. And we reformulated Formazin to StabloCal. And that was kind of the world standard. So there was a lot of actually ancillary chemistry that wasn't a part of a regular test.
Yeah, see if you can find a color disc.
Yeah.
The sequence, Kitty, you become CEO, Bruce becomes president, and Clifford dies not long afterwards. Can you just talk about the sequence and his health and what you knew about his health?
Clifford always was going to manage his health with chemistry, and he said there's three ways to treat everything. Electrical, mechanical, and chemical, and he selected chemistry.
Here is a phosphate test. So there's the graduate wheel, and you can drop that in, and then you put in your sample, and it'll turn blue. And then you dial it around.
Match.
You get the milligrams per liter down
there.
Here. And nobody had. In fact, to this day, nobody actually has a graduated.
That's as good as this one.
That's kind of the Rolls Royce of visual
testing. Isn't that cute?
Yeah, that's. The color wheel is actually calibrated all the way around.
Yeah.
Cliff's mother had high blood pressure, and Cliff had high blood pressure. Actually, the Navy really turned him down. They said that they would take him, later. And so I think getting a deferment for him to go with Ames Laboratory was relatively easy because of his health. He fought high blood pressure all of his life and took all the medication that the doctors had recommended, but we had worked a show in New York the day before. And we were walking in the plant, and we went up the stairs up to the second floor, and the last night David and I talked about this. We remember how he commented on in Colorado we have bentonite soil that when it moves, and our building moved, and so we had some damage, and Cliff commented on how the maintenance people had repaired a movement, the damage, as we were coming into the building, and how nice the boys had done it. And then we turned to go down the hall where he would go off toward his lab and I would go to my office. And he just said to me, "I don't feel right." At the end of February, he had slipped on black ice and had two hairline cracks in ribs 9 and 10. And it got on a broken rib, it wasn't broken, it was just a hairline crack. But it was miserable, you know. And I said, "Is it your ribs?" And his last statement was, "No, it's not my ribs." And with that, he went down, and it was over. Just like that. And, well, I yelled to Bruce, "Call 911. And we had good CPR in the plant. We had all, and they were there immediately. They did everything, and we're only about 10 minutes from where the from the hospital. And so the paramedics were there, and they said it was over. Nothing could be done. He was gone.
So you had a background awareness of health problems, but this was a sudden, unexpected.
Oh, absolutely. Did you have a feeling
I just didn't know it was as bad. We later found out that perhaps he really was. I had some symptoms, and didn't communicate the symptoms to us. I did not know he had symptoms. But yeah. We knew he had high blood pressure. And he knew he had, I think he knew that he had some coagulation. But by the way, going back to chemistry, this is just a bit of an anecdote. But talk about belief in chemistry. He really wanted to rid his as much as he could to get his cholesterol to the lowest possible level, and having a difficult time doing it. And he really did eat a clean diet. Like even as a kid. I remember he always ate fish and never ate beef, even and which I thought was really strange, how you could pass up a good steak in favor of a northern pike. I remember he ate that awful northern pike, and that's all you can get in Iowa in the 50s: northern pike or a steak, nothing in between. But anyway, so he was decided he was going to lower that cholesterol no matter what. So back to chemistry. Chemistry could solve it. So he decided to take niacin and just totally bypass the FDA. And
lecithin.
So he had bowls of oatmeal, and he would load them up with lecithin, then he'd put on a layer of bananas, and then on top of that, nicotinic acid right from his lab. It was unfiltered, raw niacin. And he was eating that. And, wow. He knew he was in serious trouble, I think, at that time.
Well, the doctor said at the autopsy that it was obvious he had had either maybe two or three heart attacks, and he never conveyed. Nobody knew it.
Mm-hmm. That was amazing.
Yeah,
he wanted to,
which was very sad.
Yeah.
But he was that way. Cliff was very close mouthed.
Mm-hmm.
So, what differences did that make then within the operation of the company? Did it make much, or had he by then kind of become so frustrated?
I'm going to speak
yeah.
for myself, and then and speak a little bit about R&D, and then Bruce, you speak for yourself. I'm going to speak for you too a little bit. It didn't change for me. I continued on. Actually, after the shock was over, I even came back into the plant about 2 o'clock that afternoon. It happened 7:30 in the morning. Because I thought, well, first of all, I think this is what Cliff would want. This thing's got to go on. Just because I died just doesn't mean anything stops. And I don't think I got very much done, but I came back in the plant just to see the people and so forth a little bit. But my work was pretty much just went on. R&D suffered, I would say, that they really missed his innovations, his innovative ideas, and just his comments, and just the fact he was always there. I think that hurt them.
Yeah.
This young man blossomed because all of a sudden now there was work to be done and leadership to be shown, and it was more important than ever, because here we really had lost our kingpin, but we had to carry on. Bruce stepped forward. Now, you can say what all you did, Bruce.
Well, it became a matter of a lot more, I guess you could say, the whole concept of prioritization. Prioritization and trying to decide what we can do and not do. Clifford always had a hand in that.
Because he was
the founder, so his voice was the first voice. But now at this point, with him gone, became an awful lot more negotiation on prioritization, and so there became series of steering committees, and actually this got to be a little bit more complicated, because you had to look at the potential and the fit and the continuity of a new product. But I would say, though, if you go back to that 10 years, the things we came up with, the DR 4000, so we did the DR 8000, 800, 4000, Senscion. But it was much more negotiated on kind of a democratic prioritization basis than it was before. That was the difference. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't always smooth either. There were people who didn't get a project approved and would pout about it and so forth. And in the past, Cliff would say no, and that was easier to take, maybe.
Yeah, that's good.
Rather be turned down by a committee, but I'd say one thing we made very clear. Everybody made a very strong. There was certainly no question about the mission of the company
or the
objective.
Right.
That didn't change a bit. In fact,
no.
If anything, that almost got more clarified, almost defensively. We said, out of fear that we'll forget it, probably reinforced it more than we ever had. Mm-hmm. That simplification of quantitative analysis is the mission. And so it is one of those things. Life does go on.
You talked a little earlier of some of these shareholder pressures, and of course the 1990s was a strange era. Can we go to that territory in the ultimate decision to sell
and how
that mm-hmm. developed?
You bet. Okay, well, we've already said that we were small caps, and small caps weren't and we were not considered high enough tech first of all, here I would say many people did not appreciate the sophistication of the chemistry of the Hox system. We were always it was quick and easy, you know, and therefore they missed that point. But so they've always felt we weren't sufficiently high tech. I always resented that, because I felt that actually we were really quite sophisticated. But nonetheless, we certainly weren't in.
We weren't glamorous.
Yes, we weren't glamorous. That's good, Arthur. Yeah. Yes, we weren't glamorous, and so there was complaining that that we couldn't, and it's true, we just couldn't seem to get off of that 12 number, and it was so disappointing. You know, our earnings were good, our sales were quite good, and we'd announce and nothing happened. So there was pressure on us. I would say, I don't know, Bruce, how much to really to say, but our Mary is the oldest girl, and she was not involved with the company. And I knew that Mary and her husband really wanted very much to have some of their inheritance. And they reminded me that they were getting older and that they were not getting it. And I realized that this was getting to be something of a problem, or something that had to be addressed. And so along came Danaher. And George Sherman was the president, and he, he really made a pitch to me for to be acquired, and with a very nice premium.
Did they come directly to you, or was it through a broker or something?
No. It was direct. Oh. And I dealt directly with George Sherman, CEO and president. Mm. And It was a pretty good offer, and it seemed like it was something that he promised that the company would just run on, and I guess I would say I was naive enough to accept that. But I really think that George Sherman would have kept his word.
And it might have been a little bit of an internal shakeup after they purchased this, that it was almost a silent management shift, because George Sherman resigned.
Yes.
And then his young lieutenant that he had promoted, and the two primary owners, took over and didn't represent all of the principles that George talked about. George said that what he really wanted was middle-sized companies that have a solid niche, good market share, profitable, but are having a hard time sustaining growth and having a hard time sustaining a high stock price. He said, we'll pull those together, keep you intact, you'll have a broader sales distribution base, and then you're part of a larger organization and you don't have to worry about the stock price. Actually, it's really not a bad, and he already owned four water companies, including the largest in Europe, although we're larger, Lana.
Oh, yeah.
So the intent was to pull together about seven or eight companies and have a consortium of first-class companies in different forms of water monitoring. Actually, it's not an unreasonable model.
Mm-hmm. No, it isn't.
Especially those companies that are already public and we can't afford to go private, and you're running out of options.
Yeah, and we know of a company right now, ISCO, and they're hovering at 9, profitable, nice little company, just can't break out of 9. Yes. I watch it ever on a daily basis, you know.
Yeah.
Over in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what we negotiated for hasn't quite worked out, but it does appear that there was a change in structure within their company.
Mm-hmm.
And it does concern me a little bit that the management now is not nearly as scientifically based as I guess we would like to see the ownership to be.
Mm-hmm.
But so be it, I guess. There's actually, I was two of the people last night, Tom and Pat, are still with Hawk, and they're doing fine. The comments they made to me were better than I expected, to be honest.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm glad I hadn't heard you say that, and I'm glad to hear you say that.
But that is true. We, you know, we really have the culture of a private company. We really have the physical environment and the structure and the way the management of a private company, but we were public. And by being public, my God, all the SEC rules and IRS rules on what you can do with your assets internally. I virtually couldn't even sell stock under this Section 16A without, well, George W. Bush is in trouble from it. It just made everything so difficult. It was almost impossible to unbundle any of the ownership as a publicly held firm. Either you got to be a $1 billion company or be private. But it's almost the worst part of all worlds is to be publicly held and middle sized.
And small.
Yeah, because if you're a $1 billion company, then you don't even...
You don't care.
You've got so many more resources available to you. So we were boxed in on almost every avenue.
We were.
Single digit growth and those, I tell you though, I think a lot of people would back away from some of the things they said during the dot-com boom. Because back then, remember, everybody and even if we were independent, we would be doing better than that. But that big stock rise in the late 1990s was just killing us.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And there's one other thing that we haven't really touched on, but I think it's worth. I'm going to talk about Dan Tara.
Oh yeah. Actually, as we go, time goes on, he doesn't look so bad.
All right. Okay. Dan Tara was president of the Lauder Chemical Company, and Dan owned. We didn't know it, but at the day we went public, Dan owned 9% of Hock on that day. And he loved Hock, and he wanted to acquire us, and consequently, he just kept buying stock and buying stock until finally, and this is one thing we hadn't touched on, which is a factor here, we had no float, virtually no float, because Dan was locked in on his, and Manny wasn't going to give up, and there was Grandma Kitty, and she wasn't going to give up, and there was this little bitty amount of stock down here that didn't amount to very much. That was the so-called float. That was the situation that we were in with Dan, and Dan had no intention of giving up. He tried four times. With bear hugs to take over Hawk. And he died. And then the company was sold. You know, I can't even remember who bought Lauder anymore.
It was somebody else in the similar
industry. I think it was Eastman Chemical, the division of Eastman Kodak that spun off the chemical division. Yeah. I think it was Eastman Chemical. And they put it into their rosin division, I think, Bruce.
Yeah.
But okay, that's.
There was continuing evidence that somebody might like to acquire Danaher.
Yeah.
To acquire Hawk.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But you see, but we always had Dan. I said he was an albatross around my neck. And Cliff wouldn't deal with him. Cliff couldn't stand him, and so it was always up to me to deal with Dan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It turns out it's a sort of 50-year story of Hark. I mean which is a very remarkable story. I think of individual. Perseverance, tenacity, entrepreneurship, vision, and you know what can be put together through these.
Maybe you call it Iowa stubborn.
That too. as you look at the company today in its in its present incarnation, what do you see persisting, or is everything? Is everything up for grabs in this new?
No, I think probably almost all of the various principles that we've ever worked with and developed are going to still be there. There will be a much greater integration of automatic control systems and SCADA systems. So again, this process instrument today, they're still going to be measuring chlorine, maybe 12 points along, but it will be electronically connected to a controller and be able to do automatic responses and that sort of thing. So I think it's probably more automation, more computer-generated actuations and adjustments. But I see the basic principles of everything we're doing staying together. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
I would. Yeah. I do.
And that would have been an avenue. If we'd been private, and say in the mid-70s, we really wanted to get into integrating into SCADA systems, we could have gone a slightly different direction, and that might have been successful, but we didn't. But I think the Hawk name is probably going to be. Yeah, those, as we mentioned, those 200 million powder pillows are being produced a year. Those are individual tests. So our trade name is still powerful. I don't see that fading very much.
Yeah. And you, on your very last item down here, I want to touch on this while we're still with Bruce, on the Hawk Scientific Foundation. Mm-hmm. Now, I write to Larry Culp, Jr., president of Danaher, and I keep him informed on how we're doing with the Hawk Scientific Foundation, because sure, I have an ulterior motive, because I just want him to keep understanding that we are promoting chemistry under the Hawk name, and that we already have 112 graduates, and that and the Hawk scholarship is $5,000 a year. So it's not, this is not just nickel dime scholarship. And with all the money now that we are when the foundation is fully funded, it'll be $35 million, and we should have about 100 students running. And therefore, this is going to be the premier chemical scholarship in the United States.
Yes. And if we can find them, and if they're interested, we're also trying to give some priority and preference to people who want to teach chemistry, become chemical teachers.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing that for about 2 years now. We're even hoping to appeal to a sense of via chemistry national service, that if you we'll provide you with your tuition if you teach for just a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
and then perhaps migrate into a chemical profession. Mm-hmm. That would be almost we have no objection to that. We know we can't recruit 40-year teachers anymore, so we're hoping, and that's going well. We've got,
so if at the time when this fully matures, we could have as many as 100 students running each year.
Yeah.
And you would probably know almost better than I, but it's interesting, it doesn't appear that the whole chemical industry is just massively behind scholarships, because when I've talked to universities, they'll have between 50 and 100 undergrads. They'll seldom have more than 3 or 4 to 5 scholarships in undergrads. So 95% appear to have no support at all.
Yeah.
So the field of chemistry is easy to support. There isn't.
Yeah.
And I'm a little confused at that. But it's,
I think it's interesting, because science education, you know, DuPont got into that a very long time ago, but and they went very generously to graduate education.
Yeah,
very
early, there's more.
And
yeah.
Then they've stayed there, but it hasn't grown proportionate to the field. So even there, it's not what it was.
Yeah.
And then when, if you're on the undergraduate level, it's very slim pickings.
Because we're going to a couple of schools, the most prolific producers in the country of chemistry teachers. Purdue is one, Texas A&M mm-hmm. is another, and they have none. Nobody is giving scholarships to them for chemistry education.
Texas A&M.
You see, I console myself, you know, obviously with always some of the negative things we've said about Danaher, you know, I think, oh gosh, we made it when we made a mistake in selling the company. No, we really didn't, because we're going to take that money and we're going to make a more important contribution. Danaher is going to keep the company running. They're not going to let it collapse. But we can make maybe a more important contribution to young people and to the future of this country.
It's very analogous to the Beckman experience.
Is that right?
Where the company continues, but it's merged with Coulter. You know, it's the Beckman Coulter,
yes.
And it no longer possesses the flair that it had.
Yes.
But the money has come out into the Beckman Foundation, and science and young scientists are what it's supporting, benefiting from it. Yes, and will do so in perpetuity. I mean, that's
exactly what we want to have this managed, this money managed in a way. And H. G. Edwards is, of course, very deeply involved here,